Tonight we'll talk with three experts about whether our laws are being followed. One of the nation's leading experts on intelligence, a nonpartisan professional well-versed on the workings of the FBI, its relationship with the White House and the Justice Department, and one of the most savvy political reporters working today. We all know the Constitution is the highest law in the land, but who interprets it, who protects it, who applies it, and to what end? Our first guest is a retired Air Force Lieutenant General who served two tours in Southeast Asia and went on to serve as Director of National Intelligence from 2010 to 2017. His career began as a rifleman in the United States Marine Corps Reserve and culminated as a Lieutenant General in the United States Air Force. He assumed leadership of the National Intelligence Agency in 2010, becoming the nation's top intelligence official. He provided the president's daily morning brief and held one of the broadest portfolios on the entire government, overseeing 200,000 intelligence employees internationally, along with a $52 billion budget and high-profile organizations like the CIA, the NSA, and the FBI. He's credited with improving communication amongst domestic agencies, building partnerships with foreign governments, procurement reform, and sweeping IT upgrades. He was in the Situation Room during the famous 2011 raid on Osama bin Laden and also played a pivotal role in uncovering the likely parties at work behind the 2016 hack of the Democratic National Committee. He is the author of the new book, Facts and Fears, Hard Truths from a Life in Intelligence. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome James Clapper. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Our second guest is one of the most high-profile political journalists working today. She is the national political correspondent for National Public Radio and a contributor to Fox News Channel. She joined NPR in 1985 as a general assignment reporter and newscaster. As part of her work, she has covered Congress and served as the White House correspondent during all 8 years of the Clinton administration. Now, as the national political correspondent, her reports can be heard on the award-winning news magazines All Things Considered and Morning Edition. During her tenure, she has covered all the presidential elections since 1992, and she reports on Senate and House races every election year. She's an expert on elections, national policy, and on relations between the White House and Congress. She joined Fox in 1997 and serves as a panelist on Special Report with Brett Beyer and Fox News Sunday. Please welcome Mara Liasson. Welcome. Our third guest is the only person to serve on the staffs of both FBI directors, Robert Mueller, and James Comey before running the Drug Enforcement Administration under Obama. A career nonpartisan professional, he also served as counselor to Attorney General John Ashcroft, where he handled national security matters. He served as the United States Attorney for the Southern District of Texas, one of the largest districts in the nation, with six offices, including one in Houston, and three on the border of the United States of Mexico. President Bush then nominated him to serve as the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, one of the most prestigious prosecutorial posts in the nation. As that district's chief federal law enforcement officer, he supervised the prosecution of all federal crimes and the litigation of all civil matters involving the federal government. Help me welcome Chuck Rosenberg. And of course, moderating our discussion is the man who created this lecture series, the former congressman for this district, then the 16th, now the 20th, and represented by his son, Jimmy Panetta. I had to add that. He was also the director of the Office of Management and Budget. He was the chief of staff for Bill Clinton. He was the director of the CIA and the Secretary of Defense. He has a very deep understanding of the rule of law, intelligence, and the scope and limits of the presidency. Please welcome Leon Panetta.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our 2019 Panetta Lecture Series. The theme that we have for this lecture series is both timely and in the headlines. Checks and balances. Will our democracy survive? During the course of this lecture series, we'll talk about the institutions that represent our checks and balances in our democracy. We'll talk about the Congress, the courts, the press, the institutions involved with law enforcement, intelligence, and we'll also look at the history of checks and balances. But tonight, we really focus on the rule of law, the Mueller investigation, our Constitution, and its impact on the presidency. Presidents swear an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. But the Constitution not only provides limits on the presidency, it also empowers the presidency. It's probably no greater power a president has than as commander-in-chief. The balance, the issue that we need to focus on is the balance between protecting our Constitution and protecting the power of the executive. Ultimately, it is we, the people, who represent the most important check in our democracy. And that's what brings us together tonight to discuss these challenges with my three very distinguished speakers. So let me begin by asking each of you, based on your experience, Jim, you spent a long time in the intelligence agencies and government. Mara's been covering the White House for a long time. And Chuck has been involved with the FBI and law enforcement. You've seen our checks and balances. Over these last 2 years, there's no question that these institutions of our democracy have been tested with regards to whether or not the limits provided in our Constitution are going to stick. Give me your impression as to whether or not our system of checks and balances is working, or are we ceding too much power to the executive?
Well, I, always an optimist, I think it is working. In fact, in contemplating this afternoon with the students, the very fact that we have a Mueller as a special counsel investigation is, in my view, a manifestation of the strength of our checks and balance system. yes, it's true that our institutions and our values have taken some hits over the last two years, but in some ways we're the better for it. And I think that we've shown that the genius of the founding fathers in setting and establishing a system of three co-equal branches has stood us in pretty good stead. Mara will speak and very eloquently so about the importance of what's covered in the First Amendment, that is a free press, also another institution that's taken some assaults. But I think by and large we've done pretty well. Now that's not to say that you know we can endure indefinitely those assaults, but to this point, I think we're doing okay.
Mara?
Yeah. I basically, since Donald Trump was elected, I've thought of him as a stress test on democratic institutions. And it's useful to kind of tick through them and see how they're doing. First of all, the citizenry, voters, who I think rose to the occasion, decided they wanted a real check and balance on the president and returned the Congress to divided government in November. I think that the judiciary is acting independently as they were designed to do. Bob Mueller has not been fired. The president's, in a society where there were no checks and balances, the president's former campaign manager and his former lawyer slash fixer would not be going to jail. And in terms of Congress I think has got mixed grades as a check and balance in the first 2 years, but now they're going to be conducting, the House at least will be conducting its oversight responsibilities. And as far as the press, we have been under attack pretty regularly. The president calls us enemy of the people, fake news. At rallies, you can sometimes see somebody wearing a t-shirt that says, at Trump rallies, you can sometimes see somebody wearing a t-shirt that says rope, tree, journalist, some assembly required. All of that is disheartening. What's even more disheartening is kind of not even so much that he denigrates us from the stage at these rallies, but that this crowd, you know, eats it up and chants all of the expletive deleted things about us that you can hear them say. But we are doing our job. Those of us who still exist in the middle of the spectrum, mainstream news organizations who try to be reality-based and fact-based, we are still doing a good job. And I think you could argue that in some ways, this has been a remarkable period for journalism, not for the news business, but for journalism. There's great journalism being committed by my colleagues every single day. So I would say that all of the kind of frustrating checks and balances and countervailing institutions that the founders designed are doing their job. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be worried about them. I think it's really disconcerting when you have a chief executive who every day demeans or undermines law enforcement and the intelligence community and attacks the press. But we're all doing the best we can, and we're still intact.
Chuck?
So you asked two questions. Are checks and balances working? I think the answer is yes, though I agree with both Mara and Jim. They are under enormous stress. And are we ceding too much authority to the president? And I think the answer to that is yes as well. Now, this is not the first president to whom we have ceded too much authority. You know, Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus. Truman seized the steel mills during the Korean War. And FDR probably is in a class by himself in terms of some of the things that he did during the New Deal. I don't mean any of that as a criticism. I really don't, just an observation. There's also a significant underperformance by the Congress as an institution right now, with the exception of Jimmy. But here's the thing, and this is probably one of the most remarkable features of our government. I'm a product of our federal courts. I was a federal prosecutor for a very long time. That's the reason I went to law school, to be a federal prosecutor. The United States of America loses in its own courts. Think about that proposition. China does not lose in Chinese courts. Russia does not lose in Russian courts, but the United States of America can lose in its own courts. I tried not to make a habit of it. But to me, that is emblematic of how strong our institutions are, and though they are under great stress, that they will survive this.
We've got a real test of checks and balances that's probably going to wind up in the courts. It happened last week when the president declared a national emergency. He did not get from Congress, which has the power of the purse, controls the appropriations process. Congress did not give him all of the money that he wanted for the wall. So he declared a national emergency. In order to do it, he actually, in some ways, undercut his own argument by saying, I really don't have to do this. But the issue is whether or not what he did is unconstitutional in going against the power of the purse and the separation of powers, or did he simply implement a power that Congress handed to him to declare a national emergency?
Yes.
Chuck.
Yeah. So in 1976, I believe, Congress passed the National Emergencies Act, which gave presidents, any president, great authority without defining the word emergency. So couple that fact, and it is a fact, with another fact. Traditionally, historically, the courts of the United States are quite reluctant to second guess any president in a couple of areas, foreign policy and national security. So was it unconstitutional? To be determined. Was it in my view, an inappropriate invocation of the National Emergencies Act? Absolutely. But whether or not a court will ultimately, the Supreme Court will ultimately see it that way, you have these two things running against you. Both the deference to presidents in this arena of national security, and the fact that Congress gave away a good bit of its authority 40 years ago.
You know, the thing that's interesting to me, this is something that's operating on a lot of different levels, both legal and political. One, the courts will have to decide if he overstepped his bounds. After all, lots of national emergencies have been called by presidents, but I don't think there's ever been one right after the Congress rebuffed the president for doing what he now asked for, is declaring an emergency for. I think that there will be some fact-finding in the judicial process, like, is this really an emergency? And we're going to learn that illegal crossings at the border are at their lowest level since 2000 or even years before. But I agree with Chuck. This isn't just executive overreach. This is congressional underreach. Congress has emasculated itself and basically written a law that pretty much says an emergency is whatever the president says it is. And Congress could fix that in about 5 minutes if they wanted to amend the National Emergencies Act and define what an emergency is. But so that's going to be this constitutional clash that will work its way through the courts. I don't think the president did this in order to increase the power of the executive. He did it for political reasons. And I think politically, regardless of what happens in the courts, he might come out on top, because what he wanted to do was show his base that he was fighting for the wall with whatever tools he could get his hands on, and that he wasn't going to give up. And even if he loses in the courts, he will have kept faith with his strongest supporters. Because for him, the wall is kind of the, you know, be all and end all of his presidency right now. It's really become the biggest symbol of it.
Jim?
Well, for me, I had a different perspective on this, and that specifically is that the justification he tried to use is such a perversion of the truth, which unfortunately has all become a state of normal. And it's a reason that I think, you know, Leanna and I were one of the, actually 60 former national security officials that signed a document that, you know, taking issue with the president's action on this national, so-called national emergency. It isn't a national emergency. Now, we're very used to, distortions, misrepresentation, lies, But this, I think, is so bad that I think, you know, a lot of people are up in arms about it, and I certainly was for that reason. And that's one of the overarching concerns I have about what's going on today, and not only the effect on checks and balances, but just in general, the assault on truth. And those institutions that center on truth, and I refer specifically to academics, science, climate change, the media, the enemy of the people, law enforcement, the assault that the FBI's, steady assault that the FBI's been under, and my constituency, the intelligence community. And that is what is, you know, that's dangerous for this democracy or any democracy is assault on truth. And this was such an egregious example of it that's why I signed up.
Let me ask you. I think we take the position that no president is above the law. And the Constitution provides a process to ultimately remove a president under the impeachment clause. And the impeachment clause deals with treason. It deals with high crimes and misdemeanors, deals with bribery. And yet, the reality is that in our over 200 years of history, no president has ever really been removed by an impeachment process in which they've been convicted in the Senate. Two came close. Andrew Johnson was impeached by the House, but the Senate did not vote to convict him. And Bill Clinton, who was also impeached by the House, and the Senate did not convict him. Now, the one president who probably came close to impeachment, the closest, was Richard Nixon, but he resigned before impeachment proceeded. So it's a high bar, particularly if the president has his party in charge of one of the houses of the Congress. Now, at the same time, the Justice Department has taken the position that no sitting president can be indicted. So my question is, if a president violates the law and it's difficult to impeach that president, and the position is that he can't be indicted while he's in the presidency, then what the hell do you do with a president who violates the law?
Well, so the first and most obvious answer, if you put aside impeachment, is that you vote. I mean, the way we right these wrongs is by voting. You know, to Mara's point, that happened in 2018 in the midterms. People expressed their displeasure at the ballot box, but used a really important word. No sitting president can be indicted, but every sitting president becomes a former president. And there's no ban, there's no prohibition whatsoever on a former president being charged if that president committed a crime. There are some really interesting legal issues there, including whether, if a president is reelected, the statute of limitations could run on certain crimes that were committed either before he took office or early in his term. Fascinating question. Something I've thought a lot about, but I'm not smart enough to solve. Impeachment, though, is not impossible. Impeachment is just really, really hard. And I think it turns in part on what, you know, what the reports say. I think that's going to be I don't know that it's going to be determinative, because you're right, it may not matter in the end if the Republicans control the Senate, but it might be. And so you do have remedies, but the Department of Justice policy as it stands, it's just policy, it's not law, it's not been litigated, it's not been adjudicated, is that you cannot charge a sitting president.
So just to go to that point again, if someone were to try to indict the president, then what you're saying is that decision really hasn't been determined by the courts.
Correct. It's not been adjudicated. It's been neither litigated nor adjudicated. And by the way, I don't think Bob Mueller is the straightest straight arrow I've ever met. I don't think on a frolic and detour he's going to say to hell with Department of Justice policy and charge a president. The department would have to sign off on that. And I believe Bill Barr said during his confirmation hearings that he didn't intend to revisit the policy.
And I can tell you from the point of view of the White House, they do not believe the president will be indicted. They see this problem as more of a political problem than a legal problem. And that's one of the reasons why Trump has worked so hard over the last 2 years to undermine the credibility of Mueller and his investigation. Because what they're trying to do is make sure that whatever Mueller comes up with, Trump can dismiss it as a partisan smear. Because what he thinks, the battle he's looking forward to fighting is about perhaps impeachment in the House, not going before a court of law. So impeachment is a political decision. This is why it was left to Congress to decide what to do about a law-breaking president. And it's not only a political process, it's a deeply political decision for Democrats in the House to make. Should they try to impeach a president who they know will not be, in effect, convicted and removed by the Senate? There are Democrats who have even said, Gerald Nadler, who's the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, has said, even if the president has committed impeachable offenses, doesn't mean that we should impeach him. Because impeachment can lead to a political backlash. The last president who was impeached, Bill Clinton, also spent a lot of time and effort making his opponents look like they were just on a partisan witch hunt against him, and it worked. And there was a backlash against the Clinton impeachment, and his approval ratings shot up, I don't know, 10 points or so. Leon was there. So Democrats are concerned that the same thing could happen with Trump. So that's why, you know, it comes back to maybe the most legitimate remedy for that doesn't mean that Democrats shouldn't have hearings and air all of these things, but maybe the most legitimate remedy for a president who's broken the law is for voters who are responsible for him being in office to vote to get him out of office.
If I could just add on to that, because I agree with it, because as appealing to, as impeachment and or conviction might be to a lot of people in this country, that would be a very traumatic thing, and it would, I think, even amplify more the polarization, divisiveness that already exists in the country. So the only realistic remedy, and the one that has, I think, the most prospect for getting us out of this, is at the polling booth.
Okay, let's turn to the Mueller investigation. And I guess first I want to ask each of you, you obviously work with Bob Mueller, Jim knows him. I worked with him when I was CIA director and Secretary of Defense. Tell me, you know, your impressions of the guy, Bob Mueller. And the report that Mueller submits, is it going to be simply a summary of what we already know? Or do you think there's going to be more to it? And will that report be made public? That's a lot, but.
Let me take the first part first. Working for Bob Mueller was probably the greatest professional privilege of my life. At the FBI, post 9/11, I mentioned earlier I would get in every morning at 4:30, which was simply to beat him in by a few minutes. Can I share one story?
Yeah, please.
I'll tell you what kind of guy he is. I didn't know him before I interviewed with him for the job, and he is an icon in the Department of Justice, and he was in an iconic position. So a little nervous going in, and I didn't tend to get nervous typically. I was ushered into his office, and he came from behind his desk. And I had just assumed we were going to drift over to the corner where he had a few chairs and a couch and we were going to sit and chat. No. You don't sit and chat with Bob Mueller. Turns out we had a stand-up meeting because sitting is inefficient. He had exactly two questions for me. By the way, my story takes longer than my interview. He said, why do you want to work here? And I mumbled something about, you know, serving my country and duty and the mission of the FBI. And he said, why do you think you'd be any good at this? And I told him I worked hard and I was diligent. And he said, okay, thanks for coming by. And out I go. And I'm thinking to myself, this man hates me. This is the worst interview of my entire life. I got to do something to salvage this. And on the way out the door, I noticed there's a baseball on one of his shelves, and I love baseball. So I said, oh, I see you're a baseball fan. He says, nope, and out the door I go. So I went back to my office. I was miserable. I knew I had blown it. The man doesn't even like baseball. And about an hour later, my phone rings, and I pick it up, and he says, Chuck. I said, yeah. He says, Mueller here. He didn't say, nice to meet you. What a, you know. He said, literally, when can you start? And I said, 2 weeks. And he said, see you in 2 weeks. And he hung up on me. But that's Mueller. He is the most straight arrow, direct, no-nonsense, principled person I have ever met. And I've met a lot of very, very fine men and women in the Department of Justice. He is the real deal.
Mara? Talk to us about what you think the report is going to
be. Okay. I've never met Bob Mueller, but I'm just really interested in all of these stories because one of the things, because Bob Mueller has conducted himself so ethically and not said a word, I think he's helped to create this incredible pent-up desire for him to explain all and solve every mystery and answer every question about the Russia investigation, which brings me to Leon's question. I don't know if he will do that. I think that he's not the 9/11 Commission, 2018 style. He has been tasked to, you know, find out what happened with Russian interference, see if there are any crimes committed along the way, whether there are crimes of conspiracy. By the way, there is no crime called collusion, but conspiracy, see if there was obstruction of justice. And I think for people who think that Bob Mueller is going to kind of solve all their problems, for those people who don't like Trump, I think they'll be sorely disappointed. There might be less of a kind of final resolution tying everything up with a bow with this report than people think. But I do think it will provide a roadmap for Congress, for the Democratic House, who are going to continue their own investigations. And immediately after the report, two things will happen. There'll be a big fight over the report and whether or not it gets public. Maybe Mueller will testify on the Hill. And then there will be a series of House investigations based on whatever he presents.
Jim?
Well, first, inspired choice. And the country, I think, is blessed to have Bob Mueller doing what he's doing. It was my hope at the outset that this would somehow, some way, clear up the cloud that has hung over the country for the last couple of years and the cloud over this presidency. But like Mara, I don't think it's going to do that. I think it'll be a bit more ambiguous. I think he will stick meticulously to what the direction and the guidance that he's been given and won't go beyond that. But I don't think this is the end of the process because, you know, Congress has at least three, the House has at least three investigations going, and then there's Southern District of New York, State of New York, and the Eastern District of Virginia all have various investigations going on. So. The president's legal challenges will not be over just by virtue of the conclusion of the Mueller report. One of the FAQs, frequently asked questions I get on CNN is, where do you think, when do you think he's going to finish his report? And all I'd say is I think he's closer to the end than he is the beginning.
Which, bottom line is that even though he closes shop, he gives his report, closes shop, that in many ways it isn't the end, but it may be the end of the beginning, yeah. But there's going to be a lot of other investigations that'll continue. Jim, let me ask you about, there are three areas that he's got to look at. One is Russian interference. Two is whether there was any collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And then thirdly, obstruction of justice. Let me just focus on the interference by the Russians. This was a pretty bold attack by the Russians. And it was very broad. And the question that I've had is, because this was, you know, such a broad-based attack, why did Putin do it? What was his objective? And did he achieve his objective?
Well, first, the Russians have a long history of interfering in elections, theirs and other people's. And we have records going back at least to the 60s where the Russians tried to influence or interfere somehow in every one of our presidential elections since then. The difference for this one was never as aggressive, broad gauge, and multidimensional as what they did in 2016. I've seen a lot of bad stuff in my 50 plus years in intelligence, but nothing that ever disturbed me viscerally as much as this interference and what the Russians were doing, which deliberately intended to undermine our fundamental system. And that's one of the reasons I wrote a book, because I want to do my little part, whatever I could, to help educate people about what the Russians did. Putin's objectives were born out of his deep resentment of the United States, which he holds responsible for all Russia's ills. He characterized the demise of the Soviet Union as the greatest geopolitical disaster of the 20th century. He had very strong, and we saw this in intelligence, very strong personal animus towards the Clintons, particularly Hillary Clinton, for whom he held responsible for fomenting what he thought was a color revolution during their election in 2011. So a very, very strong personal animus towards her. When the Russians started this, their objectives evolved over time. And again, we saw this in the intelligence. Their first objective was simply to sow doubt, discord, and discontent in this country. And unfortunately, they succeeded to a fairly well. And they deliberately exploited the polarization and divisiveness among the tribal castes in this country. Second, of course, was a very strong, as I said, strong personal animus to Hillary Clinton. The Russians didn't take Trump seriously either in the early phases of the campaign. When he became the nominee, they changed. So in addition to doing all they could to harm Hillary Clinton, they decided to do all they could to help him. They thought he would be a better president for them. He was a businessman, deal maker, and most importantly, they didn't think that he beat him up about human rights. And so that objective evolved. In my book, I devote a good bit of time to describing the striking parallels and similarities between what the Russians were doing and saying during the campaign and what the Trump campaign was doing and saying, particularly with respect to Hillary Clinton and her alleged physical maladies. Probably the most controversial thing I said in the book was I believe that the Russians had a profound impact on our election. They reached through messaging some 126 million people. And they had messages for everybody. Black Lives Matter, white supremacists, pro-gun control, anti-gun control, it didn't matter. And what we'll never know, of course, is the number of people that they just turned off who didn't bother to go vote. So bear in mind, the election turned on less than 80,000 votes in three states, which the Russians targeted. So in my view, it stretches credulity to think that the Russians didn't impact the election, in fact, turn it.
Let me ask you something, as long as you're on this issue. It was in the summer of 2016 that the Obama administration saw that the Russians were trying to get involved in the election process. Why didn't the administration take stronger steps to counter it and to inform the American people?
First point I need to make is all intelligence revelation doesn't occur in one day. So this, we expected the Russians, as they always do, to involve themselves, to reconnoiter, to collect against us and all that. So there's a certain ambient level of Russian activity that we had expected. So in the spring and summer of 2016, when we began to see more and more evidence from more and more sources, and then we put all this story together. So by late summer, early fall, it was very, very alarming. And that set off a whole series of endless meetings in the White House Situation Room, debating about what to do about the Russian interference. Because we didn't really have a good template, historical template, for what's been done in the past about this. So the things that inhibited us, the administration, was one, if the president, for example, made a big thing of it, went on national TV in prime time and made a big speech about it, would that only serve to amplify or magnify what the Russians, or dignify what the Russians were doing? More importantly, though, I think he was very reticent about putting his hand on the scale in favor of one candidate to the disfavor of the other against the narrative of Trump that the election was going to be rigged, since he, like everybody else, anticipated he'd lose. And President Obama was very reluctant to play to that narrative. And to be quite candid, in the attempts that the White House made to come up with a bipartisan statement that would be released to the public, from both, which would be representative of both the Congress and the White House, and encountered a lot of pushback in the Congress, particularly from the Republicans, who didn't want to sign up to that. So you can do the coulda, woulda, shouldas all day long about we should have taken more aggressive action and all that. Probably Jay Johnson, who was then the Homeland Security Secretary, and I were probably the most vocal advocates of speaking up and doing something and saying something to the public. And finally, through a series of interagency meetings, we reached agreement that Jay and I would put out a statement before the election, laying out what the Russians were doing and the fact that it was directed from the highest levels of the Russian government, meaning one guy. So we finally got our statement written and coordinated through the interagency, and we issued it on the 7th of October, a month before the election, which coincidentally was the same day the Excess Hollywood tape, audio tape, came out, and the same day that John Podesta, also an interesting coincidence,
that took care of that.
His emails were dumped. So that took care of our message, got lost in the shuffle. So we eventually, on the 29th of December, the Obama administration imposed a series of sanctions against the Russians. PNG, 35 of their intelligence operatives, closed two dachas, one of which on the eastern shore of Maryland was a huge intelligence collection activity, and imposed sanctions on some GRU generals and some others. But the problem is, that's December after the election.
I want to ask Chuck about collusion before we go to the first break. On the issue of whether or not there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians, and obviously there were a number of initial denials that came from different individuals within the campaign. But now the understanding is that there was something like 100 contacts before the inauguration with Trump associates and the Russians. There was a Trump Tower meeting with his son, Manafort and Kirshner. There was a Manafort meeting with a Russian tied to Russian intelligence and the giving of polling data. Michael Cohen working with the Russians on the Trump Moscow hotel. Trump publicly asking the Russians to go after the Clinton email. So there's lots of circumstantial evidence here that there were ties to the Russians. Is there a smoking gun, though, that ties all of this to Trump?
Not that I've seen, and it doesn't matter, and here's why. In all of my trials as a federal prosecutor, I think quite literally I never had direct evidence of a conspiratorial agreement. Let me explain what that means. Every federal judge at the end of every federal trial will instruct the jury on the law. And one standard instruction is that there is no difference between circumstantial and direct evidence in terms of how much weight you, the jury, may give to it. And the example, the paradigm example, is always You walk out of your house in the morning, and there's snow on your front lawn. Did it snow? Yes. Did you see it snow? No. Is it possible someone drove up a truck and dumped snow on your front lawn? It's possible, but it's pretty implausible. And almost any rational fact finder would say, it snowed, I just didn't see it. That's circumstantial evidence, and it is entitled to just as much weight as direct evidence. And so you're not likely, Leon, to see direct evidence of a conspiracy agreement. I wish the criminals I prosecuted were that stupid. I wish they sat down and drafted together a conspiracy contract. Right? You do this, well, you know, you buy the ski mask, we'll get the getaway car, we'll case the bank, and then everyone just signs their name to it. We would probably make that exhibit number one and blow it up to, you know, 7 feet by 10 feet. But you don't see that. And so those things that you iterated are what you typically see in a conspiracy case. Lots of pieces of circumstantial evidence that good agents collect and good prosecutors argue to a jury.
So what you're saying is that if you actually went to trial on those issues, you might have a pretty good chance.
Look, the more things you have, the better your case becomes. But I just don't want people to have this impression that, oh, it's only circumstantial, because the law makes no distinction. Mm. You know, you hear this too. You hear, well, it's just hearsay. For those of you who are prosecutors or defense lawyers in this room, you know that there's some 24 exceptions to the hearsay rule in federal court. Hearsay is admissible. Circumstantial evidence is compelling. It just is not the law to require a smoking gun. That happens in Hollywood. It happens on television. It doesn't tend to happen in real life.
Can I ask Chuck a quick question about evidence? One of the big mysteries for me about this is that so many of Trump's associates have lied about contacts with Russia. It's like, why? Why do they keep on lying about Russia? Now, are the lies about Russia evidence of anything?
Certainly.
Oh.
They can be.
Oh.
They can be consciousness of guilt. And a judge will tell the jury, too, that, you know, the prosecutors have adduced these false statements. You can give it any weight you want, but there is a consciousness of guilt that can be inferred from people who tell continuous lies about the same subject over and over and over. So certainly, that's evidence, too.
Let me stop for a moment to recognize we're at the more than halfway point, our question review team. These are the people who select the questions that I'll be asking in the second half of our program. And I'd ask you to hold your applause until I introduce the entire group. They are Chelsea Adami, who's a local news editor of the Salinas Californian, Krista Almanzon, who's news director of KAZU, Fran Gaver, our veteran question review team member, Doug McKnight, reporter for KAZU Radio, and Dennis Taylor, who's a writer for the Monterey Herald. If you would thank them, I would appreciate that. We also have with us a group of students representing those who attended the afternoon student program. We had a great student program for students from DLI and Navy Postgraduate School and colleges, high schools. It was wonderful. And what I'd like to do is to ask all of those students to rise if they could at the moment. Remain standing. There are 7 schools represented tonight. The Defense Language Institute, Middlebury Institute of International Studies, the Monterey County Office of Education, Monterey High School, Monterey Peninsula College, the Navy Postgraduate School, and Santa Clara University. Thank you all for coming. Thank you. We had a great turnout. The program is possible only because of the generous support of our lecture series sponsors. And Sylvia and I, along with our board of directors, are very grateful for the sponsorship that allows these students to come from high schools, colleges, universities, military installations throughout the Central Coast so that they can participate. So I would ask you to give our sponsors a hand as well. Thank you.